From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. And let the showdown begin. In a letter to congressional Democrats, President Trump's lawyers said last night the White House will not cooperate with House demands for information about Trump's July 25th phone call with the Ukrainian president. During that call, Trump asked him, the Ukrainian president, to investigate his political rival, Joe Biden.
In a statement in response to the White House saying it's not going to cooperate, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said, Mr. President, you are not above the law. You will be held accountable. Let's bring in our political strategist, Bill Press, Democratic strategist. Hi, Bill.
Hello, hello.
And Alice Stewart, Republican strategist. Hi, Alice.
Hi, Jeremy. Hi, Peter.
Hello.
So let's start with that. Bill, what should the Democrats do now? Should they fight for information on the Ukraine phone call in court, which could take a long time? Or should they do what the White House is saying and just go right to a vote on impeachment and make the process formal?
Well, first of all, let me say, I hope you appreciate, I bring my unmatched wisdom to this discussion today. I just want you to know. And I say that in all humility. I think what the Democrats should do is full speed ahead. I think this is a big mistake on the part of the White House. The president has already admitted, of course, he made the phone call. He has already admitted that he asked a foreign leader to investigate his political opponent. He's already admitted that he dangled, maybe not an exact quid pro quo, $400 million or so in military aid and a visit to the White House in the same conversation. Case closed, basically.
So should they vote on impeachment then?
Yes. Absolutely. They should not deter this. And my advice to the White House would be, remember Richard Nixon. His every attempt to stonewall failed. Donald Trump's attempts to stonewall will fail. And I believe the more he stonewalls, the more likely it is that he will be impeached and should be impeached.
Alice, what do you think?
I will have to say that today I do agree with Bill Press's unmatched wisdom.
Great and unmatched wisdom.
Great and unmatched wisdom.
Wait a minute.
According to himself, yes, the Democrats should take this to the floor, should vote on this, and should have an official impeachment inquiry.
Was the White House right to not cooperate with the inquiry?
Look, there's no reason they're not required to cooperate with an unofficial proceeding, which is exactly what we have now. Look, I will
be. It doesn't have to be official, though, either.
Look, there's a point to be made for that, but let me make it clear. What I do believe is that what the president said was not appropriate.
It
was
to the Ukrainian president, you mean?
The conversation he had with the Ukrainian president was ill-advised, it was inappropriate, but it is not grounds for impeachment. It does require some investigation. It does require looking into, and that should prompt the Democrats to go to the floor and put this for a vote and not go about this trying this in the court of public opinion. If they think this is an impeachable offense, go about it through the proper process, put it to a vote, and then that way we can do this in the proper channels.
So, Bill, why aren't they doing that?
Well, I think they're trying to. By the way, I'm not sure I disagree with Alice here, or I'm just making another point, which I think there have to be appropriate hearings. They have to get as much information as they can, and then they should have this official vote for sure. But look, the attempts to get witnesses in front of the committee have failed because the White House blocked them. Attempts to get the documents have failed because the White House has blocked them. So you can't really blame them for their not getting what they ask for from the administration. And one final point: the White House's letter from the White House Counsel, right, basically said in effect, the House has no right to impeach the President of the United States. I would just like to read one sentence from the Constitution. Quote: "The House of Representatives shall choose their Speaker and other officers, and shall have the sole power of impeachment." Period. End of quote. No question.
Alice, I want to give you a chance to weigh in on this letter that the White House sent to Democrats. They are making the argument that the president deserves due process, that deserves the right to call witnesses, and that they should have subpoena power and that sort of thing. I just spoke with a legal expert today on the Constitution who says those aren't valid arguments, that this letter is sort of empty when it comes to making a legal point. It's more of a political document.
Well, I think a lot of people will agree there's a lot of politics involved in this process right here. But when the president's team and the legal team, which is expanding and is growing, when they make it quite clear that with this not being an official impeachment inquiry, he is not required to cooperate with the current situation as it is playing out right now. And it is talk about whether or not this is legal or political, I strongly believe the reason that Democrats will not bring it to a floor for a vote has nothing to do with the legal aspect of this, but the political. And they do not want vulnerable Democrats to have to go on record as voting for this when they know they're up for reelection and this will come back and bite them when they have to go before the voters.
Let's listen here. Let me just play a piece of tape from a vulnerable Democrat on that point. This is Michigan Democrat Alyssa Slotkin at a town hall last week.
A week ago Monday, myself and six other members of the freshman class in Congress, all former military or former CIA, wrote a joint op-ed and came out in support of an impeachment inquiry. And I wanted you to know from me,
You heard some boos there, Bill. Mm-hmm. What do you make of that?
Right. Well, first of all, we have to add, at the end of that town hall, she got a rousing standing ovation from the people who were there. What you make of that is that this idea that these moderate Democrats are going to run from impeachment is false. Alyssa Slotkin just proved there, and she was one of the ones who held off for a long time, as did Nancy Pelosi. A couple other points. This is an official impeachment inquiry. It is an official. You can't say it's unofficial. It is an official. The speaker has the right and the duty and the power to start an inquiry, which she did. Should they have a vote to start it? I think it'd be a good idea, but they don't need it. Constitution doesn't require it, and the rules do not require it. And finally, the talk about the due process. He'll get his due process if he gets to trial in the Senate. This is like I've heard lawyers explain, like calling witnesses before the grand jury. You know, that people don't get to cross-examine those witnesses and everything. This is the prosecutor, the equivalent of the prosecutor making his case. It's not about process. I come back to it. It's about the substance of the call. It's about aid for dirt. Aid for dirt. That's what this was all about.
Alice, we talked about vulnerable Democrats. What about vulnerable Republicans? Do you see cracks happening in the Senate right now? I saw a comment from Lisa Murkowski, who's not President Trump's biggest fan, Republican senator from Alaska. And she seems to be indicating that, you know, if this were a Democrat that was accused of what President Trump is accused of, she might think about it differently than she is, which does open up the possibility that he would lose her support.
Look, this is what we're seeing now is tribalism at its finest. You're going to see a lot of Democrats who said one thing back when Bill Clinton was going through this that will say something different now and vice versa. Republicans who felt a certain way about Bill Clinton are singing a different tune now. But the reality is there are a lot of level-headed Republicans who strongly see there's something that was inappropriate in that call and it's worthy of investigating and talking not just to these whistleblowers that have second and third-hand accounts, but people that have first-hand account knowledge of these phone calls, subpoena the people that actually were on the call. That is a valid concern I'm hearing from
a lot
of Republicans.
Would they show up? Are you talking about Mike Pompeo or President Trump himself?
I seriously doubt that we'll get that from the president, but there are certainly a lot of other people that were involved in these phone calls that it is valid to hear from them. And a lot of senators I've spoken with and Republicans say, let's look at this, but it is extremely premature to go ahead and call this impeach at this point. And more than anything, it's really not great for the country to go through this. Let the election determine how people feel about this. We can put the information out there and let the election determine what to do.
I think it's too late for that, with all due respect, Alice. I mean, this impeachment inquiry is underway. I and Nancy Pelosi and a lot of people said, let's solve this in November 2020. Donald Trump made that phone call. If anybody's to blame, it's Donald Trump.
It really does come down now at this point about who is winning the public messaging, the war over messaging, right? And you're seeing some of these new polls coming out that show, what, something like 58% of Americans now support this impeachment inquiry. So you can have an election, sure, but really at the end of the day, it's about politics and how well you can get your message across. How are Republicans doing with that?
Clearly, the poll numbers have changed dramatically. I was here a few weeks ago, and it was about a third of the American people supported this. Now it's about 50-50. But the key word in that is that they support an inquiry. Let's do this through the official process. Let's have an impeachment inquiry. And that means, as I said, we can talk about the legal aspect and the political, but that means Democrats putting their name on the line, voting for this in order to do this the appropriate way.
Yes, but the numbers are moving. I mean, you acknowledge they're moving, right?
They are. Impossible to deny. And there's a trend of the polls that continue to show that the numbers are trending more for people in favor of it, but we need to do it the right way.
Bill?
Very quickly. Democrats are not afraid of this vote. I think, if anything, Republicans are afraid of this vote. Democrats have made up their mind. This is an impeachable offense. They're building the case, but they've made up their mind. Republicans are going to have to stand up and vote. And if they vote yes or against the impeachment, they're going to say it's okay for a president of the United States to ask a foreign leader to intervene in an American election. The American people do not buy that.
And if the Democrats have made up their mind, then all the more reason for them to vote and make it official.
Alice Stewart, the Republican, Bill Press, the Democrat. Thanks, as always, to both of you.
Thank you.
Okay, guys. See you later.
On this season of Rough Translation from NPR,
yeah,
we are following people who break the rules.
I mean, lying is part of the business.
In my opinion, the best revenge against ISIS is to be humane.
Am I supposed to punch her?
Yeah.
New episodes every other Wednesday. Subscribe.
Mayors from some of the world's biggest cities are now throwing their support behind a global Green New Deal to cut carbon emissions. They made the commitment today in Copenhagen, Denmark, at a summit to discuss what cities can do to address climate change. This comes just a month after world leaders met at the UN Climate Summit in New York. Joining us now is Mark Watts. He's executive director at C40 Cities. It's the group that organized this week's event. Mark, welcome.
Hi, good afternoon.
And world leaders did not reach any notable solutions or agreements at the UN Climate Summit a couple weeks ago. Now the mayors across the world are going to get a crack at it. What will they be able to accomplish that countries could not?
Well, the main difference between the countries and the mayors of the big world cities is that they are already collaborating. They're completely focused on science-based targets around climate change. Partly because they're on the front line of climate impacts, these big cities, the ones that are really feeling the effects of flooding, etc., but also because they can just see that shifting as fast as possible to a low-carbon economy is the best thing for their cities.
Okay, and what does that look like exactly? How do you transition to a zero-carbon economy? And are some cities already doing that?
Yeah, I think the first and most important thing is set the bar right. And so we started by that 3 years ago. The mayors in C40 adopted as a condition of membership of our organisation that every mayor would set out a robust plan for how they would stay within the carbon budget that's allowed to them to make that Paris Climate Agreement a reality. The city that we're in today, Copenhagen, really one of the world leaders on target to be carbon neutral by 2025. They've got a city, if you travel around here, half of the people make their trips to work on a bicycle. But look elsewhere, London has managed to now have a shift away from car usage to mass transit, cycling and walking. New York is a symbol to many with the mandate that Mayor de Blasio has brought in recently for retrofitting those hugely iconic skyscrapers. You know, elsewhere in the world, we look at Sydney and Melbourne. You know, most of these big cities are really shifting onto a climate neutral agenda now.
I'm looking at some of your goals for zero emissions transit, zero emissions in new buildings, all of this by 2030. Is that realistic? That's, you know, barely a decade away.
Well, it's where we have to get to. So it's what all of the world's leading scientists show is that global emissions have to be cut in half within the next decade. And if you look at that in an urban context, that means you've got to get in place the policies by 2030 that set the conditions for those city economies for the rest of the century. But it, you know, this shouldn't this shouldn't be looked at as a hardship. This is a huge opportunity. This is a once-in-a-century chance to take that incredible investment that's going to go into delivering zero-emission transit, zero-emission buildings, etc., and use that to fix the problems of a global economy that's failing so many people at the moment. So we can help bring people out of poverty faster with this big investment, but also make sure that the world's much more equitable and there's much less inequality in it.
But how much of a dent can cities make if national governments aren't involved in the project?
Well, there's no way around it that we ultimately, if we're going to avoid climate breakdown and get out of what is now a real climate emergency, then that has to have the leadership of national governments and the biggest polluting ones. And at the moment, it will not be possible to overcome the climate crisis unless there's a shift in those in Brazil and the United States in particular, but you can add Russia and Australia to that list as well. But in the meantime, let's get the momentum, let's get moving in the right direction. And what these big city mayors do, when they decide that they're going to shift away from diesel buses and are going to shift to electric or zero emission buses, it changes the whole world market because they're the biggest buyers of them. When they decide to implement zero emission building codes, it changes the whole construction market around the world. So they can have a real effect on the real world economy and hopefully buy some time then for the national governments to catch up.
As your mayors are gathering there this week in Denmark, there are protesters gathering in other cities all around the world, calling it the Extinction Rebellion. They're staging die-ins in places like New York, dousing the Wall Street bull in fake blood. In London, Prime Minister Boris Johnson called the protesters uncooperative crusties. Do you agree with those protest tactics? Are they helpful in your effort?
I think it's an entirely rational response of people once it's understood that we really are in a climate emergency and your leaders appear not to be taking science seriously and not to be acting, that you have to mobilise, you have to go out and you have to make your voices loudly heard. And for everything I've seen, Extinction Rebellion is taking a peaceful path to more disruptive protest. But it's a consequence of the failure of that leadership that they're needing to take those tactics.
Do you think it needs to get more disruptive?
The whole world economy, the whole world of politics needs to be massively disrupted because we're in a real life and death situation with a very short amount of time now to fundamentally change the way we live and our economies for the better, but to take out the pollution. And that's only going to happen if the whole of society really feels it is a priority and something that has to be tackled. And I think, you know, these protest movements are helping to that. But we need the leadership from mayors, we need the leadership from business, and we need national government leaders to listen.
Mark Watts is executive director at C40's Cities, holding a World Mayors Summit this week on climate change in Copenhagen. Mark, thank you for your time.
Thanks very much.
And a related story now on wildfires, which are increasing in frequency and intensity as global temperatures rise. Today, hundreds of thousands of customers in California are without electricity as the utility Pacific Gas and Electric responds to what it calls an unprecedented wildfire danger. This is the peak of wildfire season in California. The weather is hot, it's dry, it's windy, and PG&E says it's shutting off the power to prevent its equipment from sparking fires. In California and throughout the Western United States, wildfires not only threaten lives and homes, they also threaten precious water supplies. And as Ali Budner from member station KRCC reports, it's becoming a vicious cycle.
Jonathan Bruno knows that fire and water are two forces of nature that are intimately connected in the Western landscape.
You can see some of the burnt trees up here.
Today, the Colorado wildland firefighter and conservationist is standing with me inside a steep canyon at the edge of Colorado Springs.
So there's two of these structures. These are known as geobrogue structures.
He's showing me a giant metal mesh fence spanning the width of a man-made rock canal.
It looks like a colander for your spaghetti or something.
He says these glorified spaghetti strainers cost millions of dollars each. They serve the important role of catching large chunks of debris that wash down off these cliffs in the mega rainstorms that often come after a big wildfire.
We're talking about black water full of rocks, full of trees. We have seen boulders the size of cars moved after a post-wildfire.
We've all heard about these massive floods after wildfires, but Bruno says something most people don't know is the burn scars from fires actually attract future storms.
It's because of the amount of heat that's coming off the earth that's drawing these thunderheads in.
And these massive burn scars can do something else, speed up snowmelt. Eco-hydrologist Kelly Gleason recently published a study about that. She looked at snow samples and satellite records back to the year 2000.
And what we found was that for about 850 fires, which occurred all across the West, snow disappeared about 5 days earlier on average.
And in some cases, as much as a month early. It's partly because the vegetation that had shaded the ground was burned off, but also
there's still this standing dead charred forest, which sheds black carbon or soot, in addition to kind of chunks of burned, charred debris, which concentrates on the surface, darkens it visibly, and causes it to absorb a lot more of that available sunlight energy.
Gleason says it's like the snow is wearing a black t-shirt on a sunny day. And she found this early melting phenomenon lasts for up to a decade after a fire. She says this shouldn't just matter to snow lovers or people who live at elevation.
50 to 70% of all the water in our streams and pipes and water bottles originates as snowpack in the 11 western states.
Snowpack is essentially our version of water storage through winter and spring. And if it melts too early,
we really don't have the infrastructure or reservoir storage capacity to hold that water until the summer when we need it the most.
Water companies are also worried about what wildfires can do to storage and supply.
That's definitely something that keeps me up at night.
That's Mark Shea with Colorado Springs Utilities. He's not talking hypothetically either. Severe flooding after a devastating wildfire here 7 years ago did major damage to roads and water pipes. He says it cost millions of dollars, and the destruction came close to damaging water treatment facilities and one of the city's critical reservoirs. But he isn't just sitting around waiting for his worst nightmare to come true.
We work closely with other agencies that are involved in wildfire suppression, U.S. Forest Service specifically.
That's where Oscar Martinez works. I go with Shea and Martinez up to a forested area above Colorado Springs to see what they're working on together. Martinez shows me a recently treated stand of ponderosa pine. That basically means his crew has thinned out the trees.
If you had come here before the treatment, it would have been pretty densely packed with individual trees.
Martinez says when conditions are right, they'll come back and do a prescribed burn here. But even now, if a wildfire comes through, the area won't burn as hot or as fast, and they'll be able to better predict the path of the flames. And he says that's the key to how water providers like Shea can better protect their infrastructure.
In Colorado, more than most places, our forests and our water pipelines are intimately connected. I mean, 80 to 90% of the water comes off the forest in some way, shape, or form.
And planning ahead for wildfires, he says, is a way to protect them both. For Here and Now, I'm Allie Budner.
And Allie's story comes to us from the Mountain West News Bureau.
This message comes from NPR sponsor MindBody. MindBody connects millions to the widest variety of local fitness classes, and they offer the same experience when it comes to massage and acupuncture, spas and salons. Find, book, and pay all in one place. Owners can join the network at mindbodyonline.com/NPR. MindBody, your access to the largest consumer wellness network and marketplace.
Today, the Nobel Prize in Chemistry was awarded to two Americans and a Japanese researcher for their work in developing the lithium-ion battery. John Goodenough of the University of Texas at Austin, Stanley Whittingham of Binghamton University in New York, and Akira Yoshino of Meijo University in Japan are the winners. Let's bring in Amanda Morris, Associate Professor of Energy Chemistry at Virginia Tech. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you very much.
So lithium-ion batteries are everywhere. They're in our cell phones, our laptops, pacemakers. How does this technology work, and what did these scientists do to get us to where we are today?
Well, when we think about a everyday battery, you know, if you looked at it with your eye, you'd see a positive and negative sign on that battery. Those are actually the two electrodes. One is called the anode, and one is called the cathode. The chemical reactions inside that battery allow electrons to flow from the anode to cathode, and those electrons are what power your device. Where the three scientists that were awarded the Nobel Prize today really made their mark is developing the materials that are used for that anode and cathode so that they could power the batteries that run our laptops and our cell phones.
Well, and one of the keys to making lithium-ion useful is taming the lithium, which is highly volatile, right?
Correct. You know, when lithium-ion batteries were first looked at, they used solid lithium electrodes, and those are very dangerous. And so that's the advantage of what Goodenough did for us, is he looked at lithium cobalt oxide, which is just a different material, but much safer for everyone to use.
What did you think when you heard that these three scientists in particular won the Nobel Prize today?
Oh, well, I thought three things in particular. The first was finally. I think coming from a background of battery chemistry, you know, we've looked at these three scientists as leaders for many, many, many years, right? Their research started in the 1970s. And so this advance really has impacted every human's daily life. And so the second thing that I thought is, what a great thing to win the Nobel Prize, to bring science to the everyday person. And the third thing I thought is, it's a win for fundamental science. When Goodenough and Whittingham started their research, they didn't actually know if it was 100% going to be used in batteries. And that has led to something that has transformed the way human civilization is.
We should also note, by the way, that John Goodenough is 97 years old, which makes him the oldest Nobel laureate, and he's still working. Does that surprise you?
Oh, absolutely. Although I think it's every scientist's dream to continue doing that impactful science, and John is still doing that today. And so that's what, you know, keeps him going.
One of the other winners, Dr. Yoshino, said today that there's a lot scientists still don't understand about how lithium ion batteries work. What is still not known?
Well, you know, those fundamental reactions, we can write them down on a piece of paper and say, okay, this is what we know is happening. But really what governs those reactions, we don't understand that. So mechanistically, how is lithium moving? What is it doing inside that material? Those are all things that we're still looking at as we start to nail down into the atomic level.
That is Amanda Morris, who's Associate Professor of Energy Chemistry at Virginia Tech, talking with us about today's Nobel Prize for Chemistry. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, the next Brexit deadline is just weeks away, so let's take a break from the news for a Brexit edition of the Here and Now DJ Sessions.
Should I stay or should I go now? Should I stay or should I go now? Songs.
Chris Hawkins is a DJ at BBC Radio 6 Music. He joins us from Manchester in the UK. Welcome to Here and Now.
Hi, Jeremy.
Well, and you host the morning show Here, Chris. You could be found all over the BBC airwaves. How did you get into DJing, first of all?
I did it from when I was a kid. I always loved music and I loved radio, so I've got the perfect job that combines the two.
And does Brexit come up on your show very much?
Does Brexit get talked about much here in the UK? Well, I think you probably know the answer to that. It doesn't come up too much on my show, but that's by way of avoidance on purpose.
Okay, yes, a little escape for people who are listening. But the first song that you have brought us was actually inspired by Brexit, according to its authors. This is Great by Idols.
Blighty wants her blue passport. Quite sure what the union's for. Burning bridges and closing doors. Not sure what she sees on the seashore. Here slammed in and each a hand stay. Change isn't a crime. So won't you take my hand, sister, and sing with me.
So for people who could not hear what was said there, Blighty wants her blue passport, not quite sure what the union's for, burning bridges and closing doors, not sure what she sees on the seashore. Okay, so I guess we know where the Idols come down on Brexit.
Yeah, it's a huge dig at Brexit, this song, by a band that I absolutely adore. And They're very passionate about everything that they do, and that's their great Brexit diatribe. Joe also says, the singer, that there should be no blame, no hate, just love. So, in fact, despite it being fairly obvious which side they come down on, actually what Idols are saying there is that despite the divides that have been created as a result of Brexit, that we need to love one another.
Mm-hmm. Well, the next one that you have brought us has a title that makes me think it might have to do with Brexit, but we'll see. This is Borders by Sam Fender. Got a very 80s sound to it, Chris.
Very Bruce Springsteen. That's
right.
Who he's being
it
compared
like
to. And there's shades of Tom Petty about him too. I'm so excited by him. He is one of the biggest stars in the UK right now. His album Hypersonic Missiles went straight to number one. He is an amazingly talented artist. And that sounds possibly not the most in vogue or fashionable, but I think what it is proof that quality songs and musicianship can really win through whatever the genre. He is pretty amazing. His name's Sam Fender.
Okay, well, the next one is by Another Sky. This is called Life Was Coming In Through the Blinds. Very unusual sound there. Tell us about this one.
Yeah, now I think these guys are brilliant, and I think they have huge potential to break in the States. They do big, they do epic, with the shades of Radiohead and Alt-J and the XX about them. They are a London band, and their singer Katrin's got this extraordinary voice. She describes it herself as pining choir boy, and it can do things that voices shouldn't do, and it pierces through their either subtle and soft and tense moments or breaks through their big wall of sound production. I think they are awesome.
How do you find the music that you put on your show?
So it's a constant search, Jeremy. So I'm sent a lot of music, maybe 100 new songs every single week. I think it's a big part of what I do. My responsibility is to search out what's best.
And does it really make a band when you put them on your show?
You know what? It's so exciting. I think it's one of the greatest privileges I have is introducing a new band and playing a band for the first time and getting that first reaction from an audience hearing something for the first time.
Okay, well, the next one we have is called None of My Friends. This is by Liz Lawrence. This one's got a similar sound to that Sam Fender song, Borders.
Yeah, so maybe that's a thing right now. She's a great singer-songwriter who is with the indie band Bombay Bicycle Club for a long time. And in fact, she's going to be touring with them as their support soon. She's a total star. And I think you can hear how the words at least sound like they come very easily to her. They just flow. And I love that kind of casual and relaxed delivery that she has. And I love the lyrics there. I think that probably they're my favorite lyrics. lyrics of the year. None of my friends are okay. I've called you up just to cancel our plans. You're not put out. You were hoping to cancel too. It's kind of got a low-key message, and in an understated way, it's still very, very smart. It's from an album called Pity Party.
You know, Bombay Bicycle Club was the name of a restaurant on the outskirts of town in my hometown in Illinois.
And you know what? They're named after a chain of Indian takeaways in the UK.
There you go. Okay, well, the last one we have time for today is Beta. This is by Model Man. A chill sound here to wrap it up here, Chris.
Yeah, I think they're very, very cool. They're two brothers, Model Man, and I think they have the potential to really explode. I'm a huge fan of 90s dance music, and clearly that's their reference point there, and that house sound really coming through, particularly that house piano. I think there's something special.
Do you find, I just want to ask you, that music is starting in the UK and coming to the US these days, or the other way around, or both?
It depends which side of the pond you're speaking from. I guess it's a two-way street. I mean, I'm a huge fan of Arcade Fire. I played on my show this morning. I'm a massive fan of The National, and I think that they, for example, are a huge influence on so many bands. They feel relatively new, but their sound's inspiring acts in the UK now all the time.
That is Chris Hawkins, who is a DJ at BBC Radio 6 Music in the UK. Chris, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Jeremy.
And if you want to hear more, you can go to our Spotify playlist. It's NPR Here and Now. We're also on Apple Music and at hereandnow.org.
The impeachment inquiry is entering an even more contentious phase. In a letter to House Democrats yesterday, a White House lawyer wrote that the president cannot participate in what it calls an unconstitutional inquiry. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi responded that any efforts to hide the truth will be evidence of obstruction of justice. So there is a deadlock. What happens next? Lisa Kern Griffin is a law professor at Duke University. Lisa, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And what legal grounds does the White House have to ignore this impeachment inquiry?
They have no legal grounds to ignore the impeachment inquiry. They have a strategic reason for doing so, but the letter is probably best regarded as a political declaration rather than a legal document.
Well, about that letter, the White House says the inquiry isn't legal because it violates due process. In other words, the White House thinks it has the right to cross-examine witnesses, to see all of the evidence in the case, and to issue subpoenas itself. Is that an accurate reading of the Constitution?
No, it is not. What the Constitution says is that the House shall have sole power to impeach, and the House can define its own process for doing so. There is no particular procedure that the Constitution prescribes. And what the White House seems to be asserting, although it is a little bit difficult to discern, is that the president is entitled to the full rights he would be accorded at a criminal trial in the process of impeachment. And it's important to bear in mind that impeachment is only an indictment. Right. It is the House's role to bring charges. If there is going to be a trial-like procedure, that will take place in the Senate.
At which point would the White House then have those rights that it says it has?
The trial in the Senate will probably be circumscribed a great deal by the Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's preferences. But if it is a full impeachment trial, and that is a big if, the president would be represented by counsel who would question witnesses in the course of the trial.
Okay, so the question then is, what do Democrats do now? Do they have any legal options to force compliance from the White House?
They really don't. There are three mechanisms that can be used to enforce congressional subpoenas, but none of them are likely to work very well here. The first would be to seek enforcement of contempt of Congress in criminal enforcement action, which would be through the executive branch.
The Department of Justice, which the president runs, basically.
The president controls the Department of Justice, and it is obviously not going to occur that the Trump administration will enforce subpoenas against the Trump administration at this point. The second mechanism is to seek civil judgment from a court. And here the House stands on firm legal ground. Their subpoenas are valid, but that would take time. So while that might be a successful mechanism, it is a very time-consuming one, and it actually serves the White House's strategy of slow-walking the process.
Right. I think it's fair to say that the White House knows this will take time. There's an election coming up next year, so the clock very much is ticking. But could it be fast-tracked to the Supreme Court where we could, you know, in the matter of a few weeks or months, have a decision?
It's possible that within a few months, the case could go up to the Supreme Court and there may be some very monumental decisions. Ordinarily, the Supreme Court is reluctant to interfere in something that it views as a political process. And there may be some reason the Supreme Court can give for not doing so, especially as the election approaches. But that really is a bind for Congress because they are investigating election interference, and so to use the impending election as a reason not to enforce their subpoenas is a bit of a catch-22.
It sounds like you're saying it's the White House that has the legal advantage here.
I think that the White House has the advantage of using the passage of time to slow what seems the momentum. It seems, although at this point it's hard to predict what happens next, that the House will use the strategy of viewing defiance as further evidence of obstruction and just move on with those parts of the investigation that it can pursue.
During the Mueller investigation, the Trump administration resisted House investigations for months. This is an impeachment inquiry that we're talking about now, and there have not been many of those in the history of the United States. Is there a difference? I mean, is there a playbook for refusing to cooperate with an investigation of this magnitude?
There really isn't, because the posture of this particular investigation is slightly different from the small handful of historical precedents that we have. New information emerged, which caused the House to enter the impeachment inquiry stage. And it is not a response to a report that they've already received, which is what happened, for example, in the Nixon case and also in the Clinton case. So they're in a different posture. There aren't a lot of precedents. What moving into an impeachment inquiry does do is prevent the administration from arguing what it has been arguing since the Democrats took control of the House, which is that inquiries they are making are not properly part of their legislative function. There isn't any question constitutionally that an impeachment inquiry, it's right there in Article 1, is part of the legislative function.
That's Lisa Kern Griffin. She's a law professor at Duke University and a former federal prosecutor. Professor, thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.